You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today's program will feature a frank but non-explicit conversation about a subject that could be one of the last social stigmas left in the world. Despite being a common body function that occurs like clockwork for hundreds of millions of women at any given point, just the mere mention of it causes squeamishness, especially among men, and remains a social and religious taboo in many parts of the world, including some communities here in America. If you haven't guessed yet, we'll be talking about menstruation. And we're talking about the social, economic, and political dimension of the period. Its commencement can mark the end of schooling for some, a stigma to miss school for others, and an economic issue for women in poverty. For a new generation of women who are working to normalize the period and exempt pads and tampons from taxes to reduce period poverty and make supplies available in public facilities, they're working to reduce the shame and stigma surrounding this normal body function. My guest today is novelist and nonfiction writer Anita Diamond. She's the author of novels like The Boston Girl and The Red Tent, a 1997 historical novel set in biblical times that uses the segregation that many pre-modern cultures demanded of women during menstruation and childbirth as a plot device. Her latest book, Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice, follows on the Oscar-winning short documentary from 2019 to further the conversation on normalizing menstruation. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Anita Diamond, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This new book is named after the Oscar-winning short documentary that addresses the stigma, the misinformation, and the cost that stigma has on women and adolescent girls surrounding a very common process. Happens every month, menstruation, a bodily process that, as you write, almost 800 million people are experiencing at this very moment. How did this book come about?
The book came about because of the movie. It's the Period, End of Sentence won an Oscar for a documentary short in 2019. And I was actually watching the Oscars, and I couldn't quite believe it when the director stood up there and said, I can't believe a movie about periods just won an Oscar. And I thought, wow, that's great. So I watched the documentary the next morning. It was on Netflix and thought it was great. And then I got a phone call from my agent asking if I would be interested in doing a book that would be connected with the movie. It's not about the – it doesn't cover exactly what the movie's about, although that's part of it – but just about the subject of menstruation, and to work in concert with the PAD Project, which is the nonprofit that made the documentary. And that's the story of how it started.
Now, there is a relationship because your 1997 novel, The Red Tent, historical novel set in biblical times, it uses a device. The Red Tent is where women were segregated during menstruation and childbirth. Mm-hmm. And I guess over the years, you've had readers, female readers, saying, I wish I had a red tent.
Yep.
Yes, and so this has been a subject.
I made that up. I got to say, I made up the red tent. That was my invention. I had some historical or, you know, anthropological basis, but it was really an invention, and people really resonated to it. Yes, you're right.
You know, it's very interesting. In a day when every social shame, private behavior is talked about openly, most of the time on daytime television, menstruation still has this powerful stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
It does. It goes way back. This is an old cultural stigma about blood and fear of blood and a desire and need for some reason to denigrate women as less than human. I mean, since very ancient times, girls have been basically sort of chattel. I mean, one belonged to one's father, then one's husband, and that's who you were. And this mysterious process of menstruation and of giving birth for some reason was, I don't know, frightening, uncontrollable, and it got, and I'm being very deeply, you know, Freudian here, going way back, but it's hard to explain why it's such a profound and almost universal idea, it would call something that is necessary to human life the curse. Kind of says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. And it's not just in Middle Eastern culture, it's in every culture, correct? Nearly every culture.
No, it's in nearly every culture. There are some exceptions, but they're mostly in indigenous cultures that haven't been, you know, that were not quite so patriarchal, where the origin stories are much more kind of universal. There's not a god on high, male god on high. But yeah, no, this is all over the world. This is part of Christianity. It's part of Judaism, mentioned in Islam, even Hinduism. And it's very much part of the major Western, and not just the Western, traditions of the world. It goes deep.
Absolutely. And it's still with us today. And it still has, you know, in a day when taboos, you know, they're falling everywhere, this still has that sort of social force today, which is, to me, it is surprising.
It is, and yet here we are talking about it on the radio.
That is exactly why I wanted to have you on, because I have to admit, I was unsure about speaking to you about this. I'm a man. We traditionally don't get it, and I decided, well, I guess I do need to get, this is something I do need to get, you know? I remember the first time my family sent me out to buy emergency pads, you know, I went, I did it. I had to learn what I had to get because I had no idea. And I just remember feeling, I don't think it was shame as much as just embarrassment. And, you know, the guy, you know, rang me up, you know, put it through across the scanner, and it was like nothing.
He didn't care. Right?
You know, it was all on me. And I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask is, what do men need to know about menstruation?
Well, men need to know what it is, and how it happens, and why it happens, and that it's normal. The misinformation and just the lack of information, I think, is at the root of a lot of the shame. You know, there's a lot of secrecy around it, and anything that's secret and that you don't talk about, I think there's probably something wrong with it, right? So the more you know, the better. And that really ought to start early in childhood, where, you know, a friend of mine has a little boy, and he was in someone else's house, and he had to explain to his little friend that, oh yeah, mommy uses these pads, and they're in the bathroom, and this is what they look like. And he was seven, you know. He grew up with this, and the language was not scary or weird to him. That's ideal. And of course, our sexual health education in the schools, you know, is pretty weak, and there's a lot of resistance to teaching sex ed at all. And this isn't even about sex. This is about the human body. This is how it works.
It's about hygiene.
It's hygiene. Yeah, well, hygiene is kind of not one of my favorite words.
Okay.
Because hygiene means kind of you got to clean something up that's dirty.
Right, right.
You know?
No, yeah, no.
And this is, I mean, one has to manage one's period the way one has to manage one's, you know, everything else, you know, urination and defecation. We have to manage those things. There are things that we do privately, but we all know that it happens, and we all know how to take care of it. So, you know, we have to normalize this. When I talk to men who are a little unsure about, you know, should there be products in bathrooms and why should we pay for that, and I always ask, do you carry around a roll of toilet paper with you so that you know that you're always covered if you need to go to the bathroom? And the answer to that is no, but for some reason, menstrual products are not a concern, even though it does influence half of the population, your sisters, your daughters, your wife at some point, perhaps. And so shouldn't they also be able to walk through the world without worrying that they're going to be caught short and that they won't have what they need and they will be embarrassed or mortified or shamed? So, you know, to normalize it, which is why I'm so glad that you decided to have this conversation on the radio. I think it's so important for men to have this conversation.
Absolutely. And you know, the section on menstruation, it's about how men have dealt with this. I mean, I know this is a natural process, and I know exactly what's involved from a physical standpoint. But, you know, it's amazing what men have said about this process.
Yes.
You know, when Sally Ride went into space, an engineer asked, do you think 100 tampons will be enough for a 10-day...
Right, for a week. I know. It's like, and this was a rocket scientist, you know. This is not a stupid person. No, exactly. I mean, the lack of knowledge and the embarrassment around it, around asking questions, at least he asked. I mean, that's such a favorite story among people who are talking about this subject, and it's true. But that section on menstruation in the book also has stories about men who just behave beautifully, without even thinking about it. And I don't think we have great models of men behaving well, doing the right thing. So there's a story about a cab driver in South Africa who every day would ferry kids to and from school. And he noticed sometimes that there were bloody tissues on the floor in the back, and it occurred to him that those girls didn't have what they needed. So he went out. He didn't tell them not to get in the cab. He went out, spent his own money, bought some pads, put them on the dashboard, and anyone could just take them for free. And if any of the boys started, you know, teasing them, he would turn around and say, don't do that. You know, it's a natural process. Leave it alone. And this guy, you know, the story made it into the press, and so he was kind of a hero for a few weeks in South Africa. And there are guys doing that all of the time, but we don't know those stories, really, right? We know more jokes and embarrassment, but dads who are careful and honest and thoughtful and go to the supermarket or go to the drugstore and get their daughters what they need without making a fuss are role models of just basic human gentlemanly decency.
There's also discussion about the idea of what kids need to know and the fact that oftentimes there are girls that when they have their first period, they don't know what's going on. And that if that's not being taught at home, it really needs to be taught at school. And yet, if there is sex education, it's always segregated. So the boys don't know about this process. And there's talk from some of the people you quote in the book of really changing this so it is destigmatized. What are some of the things we can do that?
Well, talking to men who teach sex ed will tell you that what should happen, which is a hard sell in some places, is that these classes should be all gender, because that gives everybody a shared language. So you don't have to whisper about it, because everyone's been in the same room when menstruation was explained and what the process is and how the body works. And if you do it, especially if you do it young enough, like fourth, fifth grade, before it's part of your life, it's just kind of interesting. Like everything is interesting when you're in fourth grade, you know. So if you start then before it's part of, you know, your world, and then you get a refresher course when you're in middle school, it stops being, it's not a secret. Even if your folks at home aren't talking to you about it, you know what the language is, you know that this is something that's normal. And the teachers who are talking to you, hopefully they're representative of both genders, model really just sort of nice behavior. It's nothing, it's not hard, it's not technical, it's just polite, it's human, it's empathetic, and that's what we want our kids to grow up to be, right? Kind and empathetic and sympathetic.
My guest today is Anita Diamond. She's the author of 5 novels, including The Boston Girl and The Red Tent, a number of books of nonfiction, and her latest book is titled Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice. The book does address, again, some of the themes in the Oscar-winning short documentary, and as you mentioned, the PAD Project was the funder of that documentary and the sort of the producers of the documentary. And the PAD Project is very interesting. And when, you know, we think about this, you think of it in the developing world where this is necessary, but this is not just something in the developing world. It's in every country. There are women.
Every zip code.
Every zip code has women who don't have access to pads. And so tell me a little bit about the PAD Project, if you would.
Okay. The PAD Project is a great example. It was started by a group of high school girls not so long ago, and their English teacher, Melissa Burton, who wrote the foreword to the book and was one of the executive producers of the movie. So these girls learned, they went to a UN conference on women, and they learned about this problem. They also learned about this gentleman in India who invented a very low-cost machine so that women could make their own pads. They're really small. They're very low-tech. And then they could make the pads and then also sell them and have kind of a micro-business. And they were already working. They were doing some kind of exchange with a small village in India. And they decided they would send them a machine and get involved in that. And then this is a high school in Los Angeles, so this is a company town. And they thought, we should make a documentary so other people will know what we're doing about and understand this problem. And so they did make a document. They did a GoFundMe. You know, they did what you do to raise money. And they raised enough money to make this little documentary, which is set entirely in this one little village in India. And it addresses the fact that the girls and the boys in that village, including the men, don't really understand menstruation at all. So this is a problem of access to products, but it's also very much a problem of education and understanding. So that's the genesis of the PAD Project. It continues to this day. It's gotten much larger. The movie gave it a huge platform. And they fund programs to get machines to places in India and in Africa, but they also are supporting groups in the United States to make sure that women and girls, for instance, who are homeless or who use food pantries for their necessities have the supplies that they need as well, which it is a kind of a universal problem. And during the pandemic, when people who were right on the edge anyway had a hard time affording food, menstrual products sort of fall off the, they're very low on the list. So supplying people who didn't have access to those products during the pandemic and since is also part of their mandate.
And I learned a new phrase, period poverty. This is what you're addressing, what the film addressed, but it goes far beyond places in Africa and India. It happens in American cities, probably American small towns, just not having the money to buy
what you need.
Yeah, what you need.
And, yeah, no, it's true. And risking, you know, there's a one really lovely little documentary I saw, which was made in England, about a girl who's, you know, whose mother apologizes, I didn't have enough money to buy these things this month, please, you know, next month I'll do better. She goes to school using toilet paper as her backup, and, you know, she's terrified she's going to stain. She does, and it's actually a story with a delightful, kind ending with it, with one of her male fellow students helping her cover up and sort of manage. But the moment of panic when this girl is running through the house and rushing through her drawers and looking everywhere for a pad or a tampon or whatever she needed and not finding it, that feeling of panic, if you're a woman and you've been through anything close to this, you can feel it in your gut and you understand what that's like, and you understand, like, maybe I shouldn't go to school, or how do you concentrate on your math test, and you can't try out for the softball team if you're in that kind of condition. So it really limits and stunts the way that you live your life part of the time, especially if you don't have the money to take care of what you need, which is addressed if you have products in the schools, right? If the bathrooms in middle schools and high schools just supply products, then that would be much less of a problem for people who can't afford. And that is starting to happen in other countries and in some states in the United States as well.
Yeah, but that is still far from universal.
Yes, it's very far from universal.
Just some of the stories that made a deep impression on me is that in American schools, you know, you can have girls going to school and they don't have the products at hand, and there's no way to get them. And oftentimes the school nurses are buying it out of their own money. The teachers are buying it out of their own money. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is just so sad.
It is sad. It is sad. It's like, and in some schools, yeah, the nurse will have them, the nurse will buy them, but that means you have to ask to go to the nurse, you have to tell somebody why you want to go to the nurse, you have to make it, you have to sign out. I mean, it adds layer upon layer of embarrassment, and in a world where menstruation is still embarrassing, you know, announcing to your class that you have to go to the nurse, or, you know, whispering to your somebody that you have to go to the nurse, and sometimes the nurse doesn't have them. You know, what if she runs out? There's a kind of tension if you're on the edge there. And even if you have enough at home and you forgot and you're caught short, it can happen to anybody. It does happen to everybody. So there is, I think, kind of a built-in empathy for people who menstruate when they hear stories like this. It's like, oh, that happened to me, or it happened to my friend, or it almost happened to me. And that feeling of panic and shame, you never forget it.
Of course, the stigma in the schools is so very powerful still today.
One of my favorite stories, though, is this junior high school class. I don't know where they are. They were very careful about not locating it for, you know, internet trolling reasons, but they went to the principal in their junior high and said, we think there should be, you know, products in the bathroom, there should be tampons. And the principal said no, because he thought people would abuse the privilege, and which is, of course, ridiculous on its face. But the girls, these 12, 13-year-old girls, weren't having it, so they went home and they baked cookies that looked like tampons, and, you know, with strings on them and a little splash of red food coloring, the whole thing. Very, very accurate. And it went on, it got picked up on Twitter, and millions of people shared it. And it got back to the principal, and the principal, guess what, backed down. And they, you know, and these girls, I think in learning that, they could, by working together, by being creative, by using humor, they could create change. And I think the lesson they learn in that is not just that this can be, that you can have, you can get what you need in your school in terms of menstrual products, but that you have power as a human being, as a person, as a girl, as a woman, to make change and to right a wrong. And I think that's a powerful lesson. And the leaders of the menstrual justice movement, for the most part, are very young. They are junior high school, college students who are advocating and raising funds and donating and bringing this up over and over again to their parents, to their teachers, to their school boards. It's just a remarkable shift of generations here. I'm very proud of them.
And there's other avenues in which women are working for justice on this issue, and that is something called the tampon tax. And basically, it's just normal sales tax, but it, you know, should it be applied to tampons and pads? Some states are exempting those products from state tax.
Right, and the thing is, every state decides what gets taxed and what doesn't, right? So it's not just like, let's just exempt these products, but that in some states, Mardi Gras beads are not taxed, and they're, I guess, seen as necessities. And in other states, candy bars are not taxed, and vending machines aren't taxed, and gun permits in Texas are not taxed, but tampons and pads are. And so the question is, what's a necessity? So it's a little misnamed, the tampon tax. It's really a state tax, kind of a luxury tax, but it is applied to these products, which are necessities for a good half of the population. So what's a necessity?
Right. And with sales tax rates at 8%, 9%, some places even 10% these days, you know, a $10 box of pads, that's a dollar.
Yep. Yeah, it's a dollar. And what if you have three daughters and they're all of age? And so it's the 9%, 10% is high. There are very few states with that. They are also some of the poorest states that charge those levels. But there's state tax. There's also city taxes. Some cities charge taxes as well. So it adds up. It does add up. And there are statistical studies that show women in some parts of the country and have gone without because they couldn't afford it on a regular basis. So this is a problem. And I'm usually asked, well, then who pays for this? You know, I mean, if we don't, who's going to pay for tampons and pads in public schools? And the answer to that is whoever pays for toilet paper pays for these products. It's a necessity, right? It's not like, oh, we're going to redecorate the ladies' room with floral arrangements. This is a necessity, and it belongs in the bathroom.
Well, I have to ask you, the book also looks at how various cultures have looked at menstruation. And you have a section on indigenous cultures. I mean, as you mentioned earlier when you wrote the novel, The Red Tent, this was something you invented, but you were aware that pre-modern cultures did tend to isolate women during menstruation and childbirth and other times. So you actually looked at how indigenous cultures view this. How do they view it differently? What are some of the traditions involved with that?
Well, you know, sequestration and isolating women can be a nightmare, I want to say, and it still is in some parts of the world. But in indigenous cultures with traditional religious and spiritual traditions, a girl's first period was, and in some places still is, a cause for celebration. That means the community acknowledges the fact that it's going to continue for another generation. We have a new birth giver, right? We have new hope for the future. And in these cultures, which include Native American cultures in California, in Canada, in Hawaii, in the Maori culture in New Zealand, and elsewhere, Africa, northern Pakistan, there are cultures to this day where, in some cases, they are sort of reviving old cultures that were made illegal by white settlers in the United States and in New Zealand, but reclaiming these old traditions or maintaining these old traditions of honoring the advent of menstruation, where men are involved in the celebrations, where fathers give gifts to their daughters, and where there's dancing and singing and gift giving and learning and joy. And that is so counter to the way we think about periods today in our culture. And I think it's so refreshing to just really know that part of human history, human civilization, includes much kinder and more joyful ways of celebrating. And even in our culture, some moms in particular have in the past made their daughter's first period an occasion for a celebration, for a day out of school and a special lunch and a piece of jewelry or a special dinner at home, just something to acknowledge within the family from one generation to the next that there's been an important change, that a child is moving into a new stage of her life. So I think we can take inspiration from indigenous cultures and the fact that they are reclaiming some of their cultures, and that we can invent what we need as well, and also look into our own family histories to find if there's any way we can reclaim a family tradition as well.
You know, the first part of the book deals with the stigma, the shame involved that surrounds this that needs to end. How do we get to shamelessness?
Well, you know, you make tampon cookies and you put them on Twitter. I mean, you organize, you decide that you want to do something about it. And for a lot of young people, that means starting a drive in their high school to collect period products to bring them to food pantries and homeless shelters. And that is one way, it's a very personal way of making a difference. And in colleges and universities all over the country, students are demanding that the administration provide period products in all of the bathrooms. And this is happening in small colleges, huge state universities, Ivy League schools, and it's slowly having an impact, I think partially because there are more women in the administration and who are sympathetic to this. So there's all of those things you can do. There are a couple of things everybody can do. One of them is to put menstrual products out in your own bathroom, on the vanity where you have the soap and the hand lotion or whatever you put out. And even if nobody you know is going to need them, if you do that, you send a signal that, oh, perhaps somebody could use this. And when I started working on this book and I realized I could do that, I did it in my house. And it was, you know, I had so many of those, oh my goodness, why didn't I think of that before moments while I was working on this book. So it was a real learning process for me as well. We can all support efforts like the PAD Project by volunteering, by sending money, and just by getting informed. So I think education is a big part of this. Activism is a big part of this. And I think it's shifting in the culture. I mean, there are now, I'm really struck watching television on all different kinds of platforms, how talking about menstruation and having fun with it and joking about it and poking holes in stigma is more and more common on all kinds of shows. It used to be in the past, if someone mentioned menstruation, it was either, oh my God, am I pregnant? I don't want to be. Or, oh my God, I'm pregnant. I missed my period. That's wonderful. I want to have a baby. So that was kind of all you would talk, or PMS, you know, yeah. If you got your period, you would turn into a monster. But it's become a little more normalized in conversation. And as you know from the book, I'm a big fan of period humor. And it's entered the culture, you know. As Kate Clinton, who was a comedian who started this a long time ago, she said, you know, once they started showing commercials about erectile dysfunction, all bets were off. You can talk about anything. So,
indeed.
As it started out at the beginning, we can talk about anything. Why not this? And it's starting to happen.
The name of the book is Period. End of Sentence. Anita Diamond, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. And thank you for taking the big, bold step and being the guy and talking about this on your radio show. I appreciate it. And I'm sure there are many people out there listening who also appreciate what you've done today.
Anita Diamond is the author of 5 novels, including The Boston Girl and The Rent Tent, and a collection of essays and 6 books of nonfiction. Her latest book is titled Period, End of Sentence, A New Chapter in the Fight for Menstrual Justice. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.